Welcome to Justice Studio Sessions. I am Marianne Moore, foundress of Justice Studio. During these sessions, we will be exploring the social justice themes that have emerged through Justice Studio's work, showcase grassroots activism, and deep dive into ethical and equitable research and consultancy methods. Stay tuned to learn more about the complexities of social justice and how you can turn your passion into action. Hello, dear listeners. In this episode, we are going to be talking about women in fisheries in Fiji. This episode tackles the issues of gender justice and climate justice, and it's really interesting to see how these two things intersect in women in fisheries in Fiji. Justice Studio came across this topic as part of a really important piece of research that we did looking at LGBT and feminist movements across the world. In these movements, we found so many pioneering women who were working towards gender justice as well as tackling the climate crisis. And today we are joined by an amazing advocate, Adi Alani Tuvidalero. She is a marine biologist who is passionate about women's empowerment within the fishery sector. She started her career working in rural and maritime communities around Fiji as a marine researcher, first for a provincial council and then for Global Vision International. And she is currently the coordinator for the Women in Fisheries Network. The Women in Fisheries Network Fiji is the premier non-governmental organisation representing the rights, interests and concerns of women in fisheries in Fiji. As a passionate advocate for women fishers, Alani oversees the implementation of projects, leads their evidence-based programming and is a powerful advocate for fisherwomen. Now, she has so many interesting things to say about the situation for women fishers in Fiji, and I'm sure you're going to find it really, really fascinating, as I did. So let's get into the discussion. Hello, Alani. Very nice to see you.
Very nice to see you as well.
We're talking on different days and on different sides of the world. So you're on Fiji and I'm in London, which is very exciting that we're able to still talk to each other. It would be great if we could just start by, if you just give a bit of a background about yourself and the Women in Fisheries Network.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Marianne, for having us on your platform. I am Alani Tuvidalero and I work for a non-governmental organization, Women in Fisheries Network Fiji. We are based here in Fiji, locally registered. So the network, it encompasses different specialists within the field. I mean, academics, technical advisors, lawyers, so, and all working towards the betterment of our women fishers' lives. The organization was created on the basis of the fact that women fishers' contribution to society in general is unrecognized, undervalued, and therefore mostly undocumented. So the organization works across 10 provinces in Fiji out of the 14 provinces. A very young organization, was just formally registered around 2017. It used to be a regional organization back in 1992, and then it sort of died out due to inactivity around 2013. And then 2015, a group of women came together to want to reactivate the organization. They were able to then register it in 2017 and now to what it is today. So it's really a lot of women with passion who work as the board members and who have founded the organization up and have developed it to what it is today. I have been with the organization for about 2 to 3 years now. So we work with community women who live in the community, who use their natural resources, who use the ocean to fish, fish to feed their families, f- fish for income. Most of the communities in Fiji, as well as in the Pacific, they rely a lot on their coastal resources. Especially for these women, they glean, they fish, and it makes up one of the main protein sources for their families, the fish that they catch. So yes, this is how the network works and why it exists. Yeah?
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I think because some people won't know very much about Fiji, it would be great for you to maybe give a bit more of a context about Fiji and the lives of women and in particular women fishers and just the culture. It would be great if you could tell us a bit more about that, because you've mentioned that it is quite traditional and patriarchal with the men being in mainly leadership positions. Can you give us a bit of a sense?
Yeah, so Fiji, very steeped in culture, across the 300 or so islands, we value our cultures and traditions within our community. So the structures in Fiji, there's a government structure and there's a Vanua structure that we adhere to. It's still patriarchal in the sense that most of our communities do not allow women to bear the leadership positions. They can offer a supportive role, they can offer an advisory role, but being the leader is very hard. And it'll show as well in our political systems, where it is very hard for women to find themselves in the top position. They can be number three, they can be number four, they can be number five, but it's very hard to be number one, number two. In fact, there's never been a female prime minister in Fiji. So this is kind of what we're all, I guess, as feminist organizations in Fiji, trying to work towards, but not in the sense that we are trying to put men down. We're just trying to bring the women up to the level, to an equal footing with the men. In general, it is a patriarchal society. So we are trying to, I guess, encourage equity, giving everyone an equal footing, which has, because what it's done, everyone not having an equal footing in terms of women fishers, it means that they're just not getting the same support that they need. I think at the very least, the programs that are designed to support fishers mainly aimed at the men. When the most common term is fishermen, right? Fisherwomen is sort of out there. So because they only fish in coastal areas and they feed their families, so that's not seen as of value, because it is not seen as a commercial activity or of economic value. So it's this sort of contributions that we are trying to bring to the fore to make people see that their contribution is a lot, if not more, because they're feeding the children, they're feeding the next generation. So this is sort of things. It's a way, it's a maze, it's a whole web of things to work through. So yeah, it's a work in progress.
Brilliant. Thank you. Yeah, I think that I'm sure that the whole kind of traditional culture and the patriarchy of Fiji probably wasn't helped by the colonial legacy as well, because the British obviously came around and made Fiji a colony in 1874 for 100 years until 1970, when it gained independence. And the British culture was also a patriarchal culture, but in a slightly different way. And of course, also didn't recognize women's work in its economic structure. So that's kind of been transplanted as well onto the way that women's work is recognized in Fiji. It would be good to kind of talk a bit more about the specific effect that Fiji is facing at the moment in terms of climate change as well, because you have the gender issue, but then there's also this climate change which is coming in and is really relevant today, and it's affecting the fishing industry in particular, isn't it? Could you tell us a bit more about climate change?
Yes. Ooh, a lot to unpack there. So as you well know, the effects of climate change it's right across the board, and it's especially for us island states within the Pacific. Our contribution to the changing climate is but a drop in the ocean. It's nearly negligible, but the effects, we are facing it every day: sea level rise, ocean acidity. These changes are affecting our people, and it does not and it does not discriminate. And what, because the coastal fishers, especially the women who glean off the ocean, they have relied on this way of life for decades, for centuries, for lifetimes, and it has become a tradition. So the changing climate, sea level rise, changing temperatures of the ocean is affecting the patterns that these women know traditionally, the seasons of when to harvest, of how much to harvest, of traditional management methods. So the changing climate has sort of messed up with these patterns, and they've found themselves, they have to either adapt or lose this way of life. Even adapting in a way is losing the way of life that they've always lived. Specific examples with women we work with is, I think the Nama is a well-documented one that you can look up, the fact that the increasing temperature in sea surface temperatures, they affect Nama. And Nama is very, or the sea grapes, I'm sorry. They're very sensitive to heat, any heat changes. So this is affecting their catch. So, and there's also instances where the women have now have to go out further and stay out longer, looking for just enough catch to meet their needs, their daily needs, or meet the what they need to earn an income. Staying out longer, fishing out longer, means they, when they come home, there's still the gendered role of being a mother, of being a wife, that the roles and the duties that comes with it. Cleaning, washing the clothes, feeding the children. Them going out for longer hours does not mean that these duties take care of themselves. They have to come back and still do those duties, which means that the effects of climate change is just exacerbating the daily gendered struggles they already have in their gendered roles. So these are some of the ways that the effects of climate change is affecting them.
Amazing. Yeah, that's so interesting. I'm not familiar with all of the different sea terminology, but that's really interesting. I'm not actually quite sure what a sea grape is. Is it kind of like seaweed or something like that?
It's literally, grapes, the fruit.
Yeah.
So it's just smaller, but green.
Ah, okay.
So it's considered it's sort of a delicacy for most of these communities. And the women that we work with, most of them, they from one certain area, they actually harvest this to earn an income. And it has been a way of life for them for years. So there's actually, we did a documentary. I can actually send you the link if you wanna just give you some background. Yeah, I'll send you that link of the documentary that we shot on the ladies harvesting sea grapes and talking about effects of climate change and how it's affecting them in terms of their catch.
That would be great, and we can put that in the show notes as well. That would be fantastic. And there are some wider climate change issues as well, aren't there? I mean, there's things like cyclones and harvests being destroyed and villages being destroyed and all of these kind of things. Could you tell us a bit more about some of the wider effects that you've been seeing? It's quite recently, isn't it, that things have got much worse?
Yeah, so for some of the villages, Fiji hosts the first village in the world that had to be relocated due to sea level rise. That was a few years back, they were relocated. So right now we actually have a work with some of the women from another site that's looking to relocate. So the last time we met with the women, just a portion of the village had been relocated, while a portion of the village is still remains at the site where they're still being inundated daily with the high tides. So the women talk about the fact that they have had to relocate to higher ground, which means they're further from the sea. In their old village site, they've lived by the sea for years. Therefore, they have become really reliant on the sea. So moving further inland means it's further for the women to walk in order to get to the sea. So that's that aspect. Another factor is moving further inland, the safety of the women while walking to and fro from the fishing sites. They have found that. So this in itself represents a way of life being lost. In addition, we Fijians, as you will find that as most of the islands across the Pacific, we are very connected to our land and our sea. So moving from a village site to another is not an easy thing for us. We have emotional and spiritual connection to the land. So just upping and moving, that's an emotional aspect to be considered as well for these villages. But from the women fishers side, there's that. They have further to walk. They have further to reach the place to fish, to catch. And then once they catch, they have to carry their catch back to the village. We've had stories of women who being staying out long and not having a babysitter, but her husband just expects dinner to be ready. And so she's out fishing and she has a baby. She needs to babysit. So she keeps the baby in a half a drum beside her, floating while she's fishing. And then she carries the baby back when she's done fishing and goes back home and cooks food. Wow. These are some of the stories that we've been able to collect from the women. Yeah, and the gendered roles on top of the effects of climate change, relocating, it's just a multifaceted challenge for these women. And this whole climate change thing is just not helping really for us.
Yeah, gosh. Yeah, there does seem to be a real issue with safety. I mean, yeah, the idea that you have to bring the baby and put it in a drum in the sea rather than the husband look after it seems pretty unfair and ridiculous. So there are different roles, aren't there, within the fishing industry as a whole between men and women. Could you tell us a bit about the kind of the slightly different fishing that men do and women do in the industry as a whole?
The women, they mainly use coastal fisheries. They glean and they fish within the coast there. While the men, they go beyond the reef. So they mainly use boats. They do spear fishing, they go out diving. So this is the main difference. So the women, they're the main users of the coastal fisheries. That's why our work is mostly focused on women within coastal fisheries. You will find that there's other organizations, Women in Maritime, because those are the women who work with the maritime industries. But our work for the community is for the women who rely on the coastal fisheries, which is really the traditional way of living for most of these communities. So what we're trying to do is bring out the contribution that they do, because currently the what we call the survey that is currently carried out by the government, where their contributions is not documented. So we're trying to encourage sex disaggregated data to be collected right across the board, which is what we are trying to do as well, to contribute to the data collection. So from the outset, because it's unrecognized, there's no data. So we are trying to collect the data while we're trying to make our arguments as we move along. It is a hill, but it is, we do not see it as a hindrance, and mainly as a very good challenge.
Yeah, so you mean that essentially the government are recording the economic contribution from the male fishers or fishermen who are kind of out there on the ocean, but they're not recording the economic impact or value of the women's gleaning and the work that they're doing around the shore. Is that right?
Yes.
Or they're just not breaking it down at all?
That data is collected because most of these men, they're able to get licenses for commercial fishing.
I see.
Most of these women, they're not able to get licenses because it brings back the fact that they're women married into the communities and they can't get licenses until you are registered in what we call the Volnikambula. In Fiji, we have what you call the Volnikambula, which basically, if you're an indigenous Fijian and you're born, you're registered in this book. So, and then you marry into another community and you become a fisherwoman in that community. But the law says if you're not registered in that community, in that book, you cannot get a fishing license to fish there, which is another challenge for these women. They're married into that community. They can only get a license to fish in where they're from, but they don't live in where they're from because they've been married to another community. Sorry, this is just to get give you background, eh? So these are some of the challenges. So most of them, they find that they have to sell through someone else's license. But otherwise, their sales are not documented at all because they do not have a license to sell. You see where I'm getting it?
Yeah, I see what you mean. Right. Okay. So yeah. So it's almost invisible because they're not kind of officially registered as women.
Yeah, because they are such resourceful women, they've found ways. Eh? Because we've had women coming up saying, "I've lived here for 30 years. I got married into this village. I fed my children who are from this village, but I can't get a license because I'm not from here. But I've been feeding. I've been fishing. Now, the men here don't fish. The women do. But we women can't get licenses because we're not from here." So, yeah. On the outset, the system works. You can go fish in where you're from. Eh? But this is just another challenge. Eh? I guess there are solutions that hasn't occurred to us yet. But yeah, we'll, like I said, it's a lot of work in progress. So we'll get there.
Right, yeah. And is it mainly kind of a patrilocal environment where women always tend to go to the male families once they're married?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that is the practice. Eh? You marry a guy, you go to where he's from. Eh? Your children are registered. Like me, I'm registered to my father's village. I'm from there, and I say I'm from there because that's how the system works for us. Eh? Yeah, it works on a more general level, like because we are a very communal society. Eh? What works for the common good? Eh? But for women that are married into different villages, yes, this is a challenge. Eh?
Okay, cool. And in terms of kind of the types of produce, because because the men are going out further and the women are staying closer to the shore, it's going to be different types of produce that they're catching, and also it goes to different places, doesn't it? Some of the men's catch is going to be more commercial and the women's is more feeding the family. Is that correct? Or how would you kind of describe the types of things that they're catching and where it ends up?
Yeah. So the women, mainly they fish to feed their families, eh? And the men, they fish for where they do fish, they fish to sell for income. Eh? But now, most of the women, they have roadside stalls, which are unregistered businesses because they can't register, because they don't have equity, because they can't get it. So they sell by the roadside or they sell it to a middleman who does have license to sell at the market. So that's how they get the income, eh? For the women who do sell. But in general, a good percentage say that they sell to feed first before they sell. I mean, they fish to feed before they fish to sell. Eh?
Okay. And is that's a commercial, I'm sorry, that's like a legal reason why they can't get a business license. That's a different reason. Is that correct? That's more of a kind of formal institutional banking problem.
Yeah. So, yeah, banking problem because they don't have equity. Because for us, again, the land is registered to the whole clan, and you belong to your father's clan. So it's very hard to get equity unless you've leased the land for yourself. And it's just hard but that's for land-based things. Eh? For women, it's hard for them to get licenses, first of all. To build a business that's big enough for you to save up money, for you to be able to have such capital to generate, you can't formalize, which is part of our program as well, which is about migrating the women from the informal to the formal sector. Just getting them formalized is such a big challenge for us as well because they can't access loan facilities as well. Eh?
And one of the other things that you mentioned is that to me before is that you had done some conferences with the women and you realized what an amazing traditional knowledge that they had of the species of the sea and the seasons and all of that. And this is being really challenged by climate change. Could you explain a bit more about their wisdom and the challenges to this knowledge?
Yes, the women, because they've been this is a way of life for them. Eh? So it's become, it's basically what we know as traditional knowledge. Eh? They shared it in the forum. So the rich traditional knowledge, it comes from the use of their different ecosystem services, including food, medicine, and handicrafts. Eh? This kind of knowledge is so specific that most of it is undocumented. Eh? Things like they see a certain seaweed burrowing in the sand, they know cyclone is coming. And this kind of knowledge I've never heard from anywhere else. Yeah, and they can tell when, like for Cyclone Winston, one of the women mentioned, they saw that that seaweed started burrowing and they knew a devastating cyclone is coming that we've never seen before. So right after that, they said that that was a week before Cyclone Winston hit Fiji. So it's this kind of knowledge that's very important that I think could be used more. In order to document it, it needs to be recognized first that the women do have important traditional knowledge that can help us with the management of our resources, our ecosystems. Eh? So, and it can be used to build resilience across the board. So this is why we convened the women during the forums for them to exchange the knowledges that they have. Like I said, the solutions are with them already. Eh? But just recognizing the fact that they do have the knowledge is paramount, that the women fishers are important, that the knowledge they store is of paramount importance in building the resilience of our communities. Eh? Because they are the main users, they know. Eh?
Yeah, that's incredible that they would know just from looking at a seaweed and how it's behaving that the cyclone was coming.
Yeah.
And that they can predict that. That does seem to be, it seems very infuriating that that knowledge is not understood and recognized, you know, and listened to. And
yeah, it is. But it really stems from, again, the fact that the women are not given an equal footing in being heard, eh? Especially in our decision-making spaces. Eh? We have management resource plans within the communities, within the villages, within the districts, within the province. But part of our work right now is trying to review these plans to make sure that there's a gender lens now applied to formulating the plans so that the women's voices are heard. Eh? Trying to just get them access to the decision-making spaces and making sure that they're not only being represented, but that they participate. Because of the increasing gender champions across the board and the cause for gender empowerment, it becomes a tick box exercise for most. Okay, we have women on the board. Okay, we have women in the room. And it ticks box that there's 50% women in the room. But are they participating? Are their voices being heard when they do say things? Okay, they said this, but is it being heard? So these are some of the things that we are still trying to push for right across the board. And that's part of our ongoing 3-year project funded by, I think, USAID, that we are trying to review the plans, the resource management plans of one of the districts that we work in, and just trying to empower the women of how to inject their voices within the plans that's already been had. We asked these women, do you know that this plan exists? And they did not know. This plan is to better manage their resources. They are the main users of the resources, that they do not know that these plans exist because they were not informed. Also, when these plans were consulted, when these plans were made, consultation was made, yes. But when a consultation is made within the village, it's the men who are in the consultation and the women go to prepare food for the people who come to do the consultations in the village. That's why part of our approach too is to get the women out of the village. We come hold the workshops for them, because if we're doing it in the village, half of them will be in the workshop while half of them is still trying to make food for the people in the workshop. It's all sides has to be considered. I'm sorry if I'm a bit all over the place with my explanations, but I could go on and on with this. Just so much to unpack here.
Yeah, no, not at all. There is so much to unpack. Every kind of strand leads to another strand. And
Yes.
I know that that even this idea about, or the fact that women are doing their fisheries work, but then they're also looking after the family and doing their care work. You've looked into this as well, haven't you, recently, about kind of the proportion of what the women are doing?
Yes, care work. So another one of our projects is where we use the RCA toolkit, the Rapid Care Analysis Toolkit, where we just try and assess. Eh? So we get the women together in a room and we get the men together in a room. So we ask the women, what do you do with your 24 hours in a day? And then they say, from this time to this time, I wash the clothes. From this time to this time, I get the kids fed. From this time, I rest. Then I wake up at this time. So then we total up the hours and then we do the same exercise with the men. What do they do? Yeah. So that kind of data, and then we presented the women's hours to the men and the men's hours to the women, the reactions on the men's faces to see what happens in their wives' days is, I think, in an experience in itself. Eh? So we've had reports of some men saying, I did not, like when you put it like that, it's just, wow, and they just couldn't, some couldn't speak for a while. Yeah. Because they just assumed that all they, one said, we just assumed they were just lying down, resting. Because they don't see. Yeah. So that work was funded by Oxfam, and we're trying to, and it's a 5-year program, eh? And we're trying to replicate that work across the board as well, across the districts that we work in, because it's just basically the undervaluing of work carried out essentially by these women, eh? And it's become a significant driver for poverty, for inequality, just because this care work is not recognized there, and it's expected of them. Yeah. So I think to get down to the numbers of it, one of the districts that we worked in, on average, a woman, she spends 67 hours on care work per week, compared to 30 hours for a man.
Right.
And in the second district, on average, a woman spends 80 hours per week on unpaid care work, while a man spends 47 hours. There's nearly a 50% difference in how much time each spends on just caring, eh? Caring for the elderly in the home, caring for their spouses, caring for their children. And then you see the non-work, eh? Non-work hours. Eh? On average, a woman spends, in one of the districts that we work in, spends 71 hours per week on non-work. That's basically leisure and sleeping hours. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
While the men, 94 hours. You can already see the big difference. Eh? Yeah. So that's when we get down to the small numbers. Eh? And then what we also collect data on is the perceptions of care work. Eh? How, what they see as their roles and whose role it is to care. So most of them, of course, expect the woman. Like, we would expect that we look after our own mothers. Eh? Some expect their wives to look after their mothers. It's just because she's a woman, her job is to care. So when you present this kind of numbers back to them, especially to the men, it's such an interesting experience to watch. Just the reactions on their faces and how they react. Eh? Again, a work in progress. So we're on to our fourth province this year in just trying to collect data, this kind of data, and reporting on it. Eh? Just so there's some data around the care work that the women fishers do, because this kind of work is normal at home. They then have to fish. That's just the added ones, eh? Care work, eh? They still have to fish and they still have to come home and still do the care work, which is expected of them. And it's just a challenge when things such as effects of climate change exacerbate the challenges that they already face daily, eh? So part of this project is identifying as well the problematic care activities, eh? What I mean is basically work that affects your time, mobility, and health, eh? So to feed their children, they go out fishing. So one of the fisher women's group, they said they need help because staying out longer means they're getting colder. So then we asked them, so how do you think we should support you? How can we help? Like, they just need wetsuits or diving suits just to keep them warm, if only for a while. Because when they get home, they're not resting. They get home, they still have their duties to do. Eh? Another one is they say that a big part of caring at home is water. See how basic it really is, eh? That we take for granted. Mm-hmm. To wash the dishes, to clean the house, they need water. And in order to get this water, they don't have it readily. They have to walk a certain distance. a good part of her hour is just to fetch the water needed to wash clothes, to feed, before her duties are done, and then she can go out fishing.
Yeah,
so we asked, okay, so how can we help with that? She said, just get a big tank for 10 houses so that they can have water readily available, which shortens their time just to fetch water for their daily duties. And then they have more time to fish. We got them a tank. Again, I'm emphasizing also the need to hear that the solution comes from them and not us coming in with our ideas of how best it should work for you, but they have the solutions themselves, which again, emphasizing the fact that the women fishers know a lot and that their voices and their opinions need to be heard.
Yeah. No, so important, of course. And this is the frustrating thing that they're, just everywhere not being listened to enough, are they?
Yeah. It's such a, so for some villages, like I said, the assistance that's offered for fishers is mainly boats, the kind of fishing gear that fishermen use. So when we go to the villages right now, most of them, they list fishing gear that they use for fishing, for netting, for harvesting whatever catch it is that they do have. It can be small as just a small net or a snorkel and a mask and some harvesting gear. Because this kind of assistance is not offered generally because it's the fishermen who are assisted mostly. Yeah? Like you can ask for a boat from government assistance and it's given. Another difference is one of the communities asked for a boat and then it was given for the women. None of these women had certifications to drive a boat, which again, we can see how there's a big gap in how the women are just not well placed right now to grow, to move from informal to the formal sector. So yes, they were given a boat, which is to encourage them to build their business bigger. But then they realized no one could drive the boat, which is another thing that we found like it was ridiculous, if I may say so myself. So approaches need to be gender sensitive. You're giving a boat to a community, you're just expecting everybody to have a boat license. Boat master license is what they call it. But the men, of course, have it. The women do not. Because they're just not expected to have it. And therefore, they don't have it. Yeah, it's such a... Yes. Work in progress. I always tell myself work in progress.
Yeah, can you tell us a bit more about this formal and informal difference and kind of what you're doing to help women with these financial and kind of registration issues and licensing issues?
Oh, yeah. Yes, from the get-go, in order to start with any formal business practice, most of our work is also centered around capacity building, strengthening the capacities in general for starters, financial literacy, because most of these workshops when offered, the women fishers are out fishing when it's offered within the villages. So we try and specifically target them. Okay, so we have a financial literacy training. Who wants it? Who wants it done? So then the women, the different communities that do want it, they let us know, okay, when's a good time to have it. And when we do have it, we bring them out of their villages so they can come and just sit and focus and listen. They're not worrying about children. They're not worrying about feeding people, because I don't know if you've heard of the Fijian hospitality. We'll be worrying about whoever comes into our village. Has he eaten? We need to feed him, and we'll be making special food. And that hospitality is the women cooking. So when a team comes into a village to come do a financial literacy training, these women will be out there cooking for the financial literacy trainers, when in fact the trainers are there to train them, but they will go and cook while another group gets trained. So the recognizing these little things and then getting them out of the village so they can train them. And then they say, wow, a day out like this is a day out of the sea, just sitting and just learning and then going back. And it's such a big difference in the way that they receive the project and they take ownership. And it's just so encouraging, the reactions that we do get. And it's, I will say, we are making good progress, as we are growing and we're getting more interest from the women fishers. You will, in fact, just yesterday, two women fishers from a maritime island, they just came and they wanna come talk to you. They wanna be members of the network because they want these kind of workshops to come to them to specifically target the women fishers.
I'm fantastic.
Just recognizing the wealth of knowledge that they have and making space, a seat at the table for them.
Yeah, that's really fantastic that it's expanding and getting more popular. Yeah. I definitely have experienced Fijian hospitality, of having been very lucky to visit Fiji and and visit some nice places and have some lovely food. So I can imagine what you're saying as you're explaining it, and yes. Yeah, that does seem to be a real issue. Being able to kind of give the women the space when they already have so much that they're doing in their lives, aren't they? And then you're trying to make their lives better, but of course that's more time when they're already doing care work, doing fishing, doing all of these different things for everybody else.
Yeah.
I know that you've mentioned around that you are an activist organization, but that you can't be too activist. Mm-mm. Because there are some kind of traditional things that you're working with. Could you say a bit more about mm-mm. how you're able to navigate the enhancing women's equality and what are the challenges there?
Right. Our women fishers, they live in the village, like I mentioned. So they live in a village and they adhere to the traditional structures of the village, of the Fijian culture. Like I said, it's mainly patriarchal in nature. And us working with the women, we have to be mindful that we do not want to disrupt the traditional systems that they adhere to, because at the end of the day, we live and they still have to live within that system. So instead of disrupting, what we try and do is we'd like to, what I think, peacefully alter the system through them, with them, and mm-hmm. engaging with the men especially. This work, even though it's women fishers, an important part of it is engaging with the men. Just to let them know, because it's not a zero-sum game where the men are pushed down and the women are pushed up. We're just really trying to get the women up, like I said, to an equal footing. Because once the community decides, we don't want you here, that's it. We're trying to peacefully alter for them to see the value in listening to their women.
Mm-hmm.
It only means it's only a win-win situation. There is no loss in listening to your women, is what basically we're trying to get them to see. There is no loss. And in order to do that, we need to get them to listen first. And we can't be aggressively attacking. Your culture is bad. Your culture is good. So I believe in dialogue. I believe in talking things out rather than aggressively fighting. Yeah,
of course, definitely.
I don't know if you got to drink kava as well while in Fiji. Did you get to drink kava? Yeah. So a lot of these conversations take place around the kava bowl for me, making time for when the men sit with kava. You make time, you sit and you talk with them to see that you're not here disrespecting the culture, because this is also my culture and I understand the nuances of what it means. You sit and you make time and you dialogue. Emphasize to them the value of listening to the woman who knows about that seaweed that burrows and the signs that she could read from far off. And it's just, there's nothing to lose, really. They have nothing to lose.
Yeah. Mm. What are the fears that come from them or that have come out as you've been dialoguing?
Altering the culture. I think change is always, people fear change, is what I think. Change is, but I think a progressive leader who listens sees that change is always for is for the better in terms of listening to their women. Eh? I have a very progressive father who's a very empowering father for us. There's three sisters, and he's always pushing for us women in the family. So I take that as a lesson, and I try to project that in the work that I do, believing in the goodness of the current male leadership, that they will give you an ear and they will give you a voice. Yeah, so I have a very good base to project that onto and how to sort of navigate these spaces because of the background that I was brought up in.
That's really lovely.
Yeah. It is lovely for me, and I'm just trying to, I mean, it's the conversations with women is always very enriching, and I'm actually looking forward to meeting this two women who want to be members, and they want to meet up today. They just want to sit and talk, and I'm looking forward to it, because the kind of stories that they bring to you, I tell you, every story that they tell you is data, because it's always new knowledge we've never heard before. I tell people about the seaweed that burrows, and they're just shocked, because then it displays an animal characteristic, but it's a weed, and it's yes, it still gets people shocked. Eh? And this is undocumented. Yes, yeah.
And just to know the land so much, or just to know the sea so much, yes, and know what's happening, that you can notice these tiny changes and see how that, you know, creates a larger change, or is an indication that something larger is happening. It's just incredible that I think it's everywhere that we've lost this knowledge in so many different countries. We're not attached to the land anymore, and we've kind of lost an awful lot of wisdom that we had when we were closer to the land in general. Yes,
exactly. Mm. Yeah, it's this kind of traditional knowledge, especially for coastal communities. I'll give you another example from where I'm from, because we have traditional fish totems, we have traditional plants that belongs to each district or clan, depending. So where I'm from, we have a fish that we eat, that we seasonally harvest. So we will know when to eat this fish when a certain species of fish is not following it, which means it's poisoned. That's when we know not to eat it. So it's this kind of traditional knowledge that is passed down through the generations that is not being documented. And it's this kind of knowledge is with the women, and it's just amazing.
Yeah, we don't want to lose this. And so the irony, as you say, is that Fiji has really not contributed to climate change at all. Mm. It's been the Western countries, it's been these big polluting countries that have been contributing to climate change and causing climate change, but you're bearing the brunt of it. How do people in Fiji feel about that?
We have a good number of people who are getting very frustrated. Like I said, I believe in dialogue, although there's been a lot of dialogue, I think, around these issues. But I like to put it in a nutshell in this way. These big countries, these big emitters of countries, they found a way to reach the moon. They found a way to deep dive. This is smaller. They have enough political will, they can find a solution to these big emissions, maybe finding an alternative. Yeah, they've solved bigger problems than this. Of course, given enough will, they can find a solution to all this changing of climate and this the way it's affecting our small island countries. The way, to me, in a nutshell. They've solved way bigger things than this.
Well, I think the problem is the ideology behind it, isn't it? So going to the moon is kind of very grand, and it makes you feel like a kind of big, clever person, or that you can do that. There's some fundamental problems as well around how we even record the natural environment in our economic system, and that, you know, the fact that not just do we have women's workers invisible or care workers invisible, but also the natural environment just isn't counted until it's been mined or fished or destroyed in terms to make firewood if it's a forest, and all of this kind of thing. We have kind of fundamental metrics which aren't supporting, you know, a world which doesn't actually genuinely care about its natural environment. And it's a horrible consequence of of misplaced values and not really fully appreciate.
Misplaced values is what it is, yes.
Yeah, it's really, really, yeah. really awful. And yeah, you're right. If there was, I mean, I do believe that, it, yeah, if there was the will, it would happen. But it's because they don't, well, the people who have the power to change it don't care enough.
Don't have the right things. Yeah, don't care enough.
Yeah, it's very frustrating to see that play out. Yeah. And I can't imagine how horrible it must be to also just be on the receiving end of village relocations and harvests being destroyed and all of this kind of stuff. It just makes it even more difficult and unfair.
Yes, yes, very. It's sort of like an extractive industry. Yeah, we in the cultures of the Pacific, we see ourselves as we are here to mind, not mine, mind, look after, look after. We're custodians of our resources. Eh? We do not, yeah, we see ourselves as custodians and we're here to look after. Rather than to get from, to benefit from, we look after the land. Eh? And it's this sort of, I think, state of mind that needs to change for these big countries. Eh? They see land, they try to think of what they can get out of it rather than what they can give to it. Eh? And it's sort of that state of mind that needs to change on that global level. Eh? How they can make a place better rather than what can they can take from that place. Eh? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree. Completely agree. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's been really amazing and interesting to listen to you talk about the Women in Fisheries Network and the fisherwomen and all of their knowledge and what they've been doing. Are you able to just tell us what does the future hold? What's the kind of the next things that you're looking at in the network?
Oh, well, we're just trying to, at the end of it all, it's really well, the policy that matters. Eh? So we'd like to see if we can influence policy into making lives better for these women, eh? How they can get access to finance. Eh? Just to being able to register a business is such a big thing for these women, eh? To me, in the end, it's all about policy. Yeah, we're collecting these stories, we are collecting this data in order to get their voice recognized in all our resource management plans, where their voice matters, and eventually, we are trying to get their communities to hear them, the cultures that they live within. Because it'll only serve everyone for the better. Eh? And for the network as a whole, we're trying to see if we can reach the whole of Fiji. And we have a national forum coming up in where we'll convene the members from around the 10 provinces. We're hoping to make sure that it's an annual thing now. So that it, and if we can, if the network can also branch out to the region, we will see. We've had interest from other Pacific Island countries, and I've just told them that we just currently have the capacity to look after national interests before we can start to branch out in the region, like the network used to be back in the 90s. Eh? That's what we're hoping, where the organization can get to. But it's always about making the women fisher lives better. That's what it is for us. Eh?
Amazing! You're doing such amazing work, and I'm sure that so many people listening will be wanting to support you and find out more about you. So how can they do that?
Okay, like every organization, we are donor driven. We are mainly funded through the grants that we apply for and get from the different funders that we have. A strategic plan can be accessed on our website. The kind of work that we do, the kind of funds that we do, and the amount of funds that we need to keep the work going. Yeah. So we have a 5-year strategic plan that can be accessed on our website. And that's the main way that people can help. Yeah. Just donations, just to help these women on how to carry out the strategic plan. Because the strategic plan was formulated, informed by the women fishers themselves, yeah, on the kind of help, kind of support that they need. So We also have volunteers within the organization that comes and lend a hand on the data collection, on data analysis, and who become network members. And basically, whatever kind of specialist skills they can offer the organization. Eh? Most of the network members, they offer their specialist skills. For example, financial literacy workshops, sometimes run by people from the financial sector who offer their time for the network in kind. We also have people from the legal background that we're trying to arrange now, just to give the women fishers a background on the fisheries policies and laws, how they can better navigate the space. We're also relying on our network members for that. So these are the different kinds of ways that people can help in trying to better the lives of these women fishers.
Brilliant, thank you. And if people want to just hear about your work or just follow you, is there any social media or anything that they can follow to do that?
Yes. We are present on Facebook, Women in Fisheries Fiji, and we are also Women in Fisheries Network Fiji. We're also on Twitter, Women in Fisheries, with the same handle, Women in Fisheries Network Fiji, and we're also on Instagram, Women in Fisheries Network Fiji. Ah, thank you for reminding me, Marianne.
Amazing. Well, that's great. Well, we can all follow you there then. So that's brilliant.
Yes, you're most welcome to.
Wonderful. It's been so interesting. I had no idea how interesting it would be to discuss this topic and kind of the lives of women fishers or fish women and how they're going and how they know so much about the traditional land and all of the different work that they're doing and how they're juggling everything. And it's just really, really fascinating to hear about it. So thank you so much for giving the time and telling us about this. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Marianne, for the platform. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Justice Studio Sessions. We have so enjoyed deep diving into social justice with you. Justice Studio provides compassionate consultancy rooted in social justice. If you would like to work with us, please visit our website at www.justicestudio.org or email us at info@justicestudio.org. This podcast relies on your support. If you love our content and would like to see this podcast reach more people, please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating or leave us a lovely review. We would be delighted for you to share your thoughts, musings, or favourite parts of the podcast with us on social media. You can tag and or follow Marianne at creatrix.london and Justice Studio at Justice Studio on all the major social sites. This podcast was hosted by Marianne Moore and produced by Justice Studio Limited. The music was by Luke Fraser at The Tonic and the artwork was by Marianne. Thank you so much for listening.